Ed, I heard you in the background. You were a lot of noise, and then you cut off completely. So time to wiggle that antenna or pick up the gain a bit.
He said, why would you want to? Solid-state stuff uses more modern components that don't age out. So I'm not sure why.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
NY2H.
Yes, Lou.
All right, I'm wondering if there's an advantage to bringing up the variac at a very slow rate, considering that electrolytic capacitors form the electrolyte under DC voltage, and if they're old, perhaps bringing it up slowly will allow time for the chemical reformation of the electrolyte.
That's where we were half an hour ago. Yes, absolutely. Didn't they have done that? WB2EAZ.
Yes, I would agree along with that. We kind of covered that. That's one of the major reasons that I'm led to understand that so many people will do it at a very, very, very slow rate. The difference between people's and their approaches to variac is some just use it as a protection of not shorting out and blowing all the fuses and releasing the magic smoke. But the people who turn up the variac very, very slowly over hours are hoping that they can reform the electrolytic layer of the old-time electrolytic capacitors.
KD2FIU.
I missed the comments, so I'm late to the ball game here. All right, very good, thank you.
KD2FIU for Anderson.
Okay, GJE wanted to make a comment, so first GJE and then you, George. How's that?
Hey, to GJE, the procedure is supposed to work. After going through it and bringing up the voltage over a period of hours, it may or may not work. These new electrolytics, first of all, they're very small. They're about a quarter of the size of the one you're going to cut out. They're expensive. If I had a 40-year-old boat anchor and I wanted to bring it out again, I would just replace those electrolytics with new electrolytics and call it quits, period. Over.
Okay. I would agree with you, Ed. The quality of new capacitors is much better than the old ones. You'll have a longer life expectancy by swapping them out. It's a little bit extra work. I mean, sometimes people will do the slow uptake with the variac and get by for a little while and then still, buy some appropriate electrolytic capacitors and swap out the old ones nevertheless, even if they can be spared. So I agree with you. George, you wanted to make a comment on this?
KD2FIU. GJE mentioned something. GJE mentioned something very important here. It's the vintage and years. Okay, something from the middle 1960s or late 1950s we may not be able to bring up, or may be able to bring up in a long period of time, a few hours, with the variac. 40 years old is 1980s. We didn't have such delicate capacitors in 1980. And that you may be able to bring up over 1 to 2 hours. And I do that. I've done it because I have a nice variac, a nice high current capable variac and good voltage regulation variac. I generally give it 2 hours if it has not been brought up in decades. One decade to 5 years, I'll give it an hour. AC in to the transformer. That's my way of doing it. Once you get into radios built in the early 90s, you have very, very, very different problems. Built with rare metals that have not had control to properly ground the integrated circuits to the boards. Now you're dealing with ESD problems that you've never seen. That you would see that those are problems that you turn on the radio and touch it and have different kinds of problems. So we're talking about a lot of different things with vintages of minerals that we've put together over the years to make the electronic equipment that we want to convert into electromagnetic waves to go through our conductors in the sky. But I find that for myself, if you said to me a 40-year-old radio, that's 1980, 1983, 1979. That's a radio that I would bring up over an hour and a half or 2 hours.
Wait a minute. The kind of radio you're describing hasn't been built since the 50s.
No, Roy, can you hear Ed and bring that to me? Please bring a relay.
Ed is telling you that the way that Wayne is describing his radio speaks more of a 1960s vintage than a 1980s. My understanding at the time was that it was an interesting hybrid that Kenwood had that included both solid-state components and vacuum tubes, although Wayne suggested that it's a purely vacuum tube-based transceiver device. And Ed points out that things like that are very unusual for 1980.
Absolutely, no. If it was all tubes in the 60s, Kenwood came out with hybrids in the 70s that used a 12 3x7 driving a pair of 61 46s, and everything else was solid state.
Negative. This one has got the 6JS6Cs. It has the sweep amplifier finals. It's probably early 1970s, which is still okay. You bring it up very slowly. But it's very different from 1980. Somebody mentioned a 40-year-old. 40-year-old is 1980. There's a different way of bringing that up. It's a different formation of components. It's very different from 1968 versus 1974 versus 1980 versus 1994. Very, very, very different. So you can't just say Variac applies to all of this. It has to do with certain formation of compositions that made the components that we want to protect. KD2, FIU.
Okay, I assume from the silence everyone is tired of kicking this poor dead horse. As I started this off at the very beginning, I wish Wayne a great deal of luck, and I hope that he figures out an inexpensive means to get his radio to work correctly, and I'm sure that Andy is talking to him as we speak, telling him what his ideas on the subject are. So once again, want to thank everyone, George, 3S, EAV, GJE and P. Thanks to everyone who, Wesley and all the other people who had things to add. But I think we've done this thing. So I'll just drop for a second and make sure no one else has any comments along the same line.
This is KD2UDU. Thank you, Roy. I have spoken to Andy. He has some suggestions, but we're actually going to wait to get together and go over it together. So thank you all for your help. This is KD2UDU.
Okay, very good, Wayne. I wish you luck with it. I hope you get a lot of pleasure out of it. And please, if you can fix something up that works on 10 meters on a Sunday morning, we're here. We're always there at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband.
All right, Roy, I'm looking forward to being on that frequency. I'll be listening.
Okie doke, very good. Well, before I turn it over to Paul, I did mention I had puzzles. Probably we have time for just one tonight. I'll save the rest for some other time. Hopefully you guys will and gals will kind of enjoy this one. Hopefully people know about something called lichens. They cover about 6-8% of the Earth's land surface. So my question, my little puzzle for tonight is, what the heck are lichens? Are they plants? Are they animals? What the heck are they? Anyone with any ideas? And please, don't Google it, because, you know, we can all Google stuff. I just want it off the top of your head, if possible.
KD2UDU, I think I have an answer for you, Roy.
Sure, Wayne, please.
As far as my memory goes, I believe a lichen is a combination of an algae and a fungus living together, I forget the word, where they basically scratch each other's back, but that's not the scientific word.
Symbiotic.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can call it symbiotic relationship. You can call it a composite organism. It's, as Wayne mentioned, it's the algae supplies the energy from the sunlight. The fungus supplies the structural integrity because they're single-celled algae cells. And the two of them form such a unique, and it's different in different places. The type of fungus, bacteria, differs from place to place, but they're all considered lichens. And as I mentioned, they cover 6-8% of the entire Earth's land surface. So that's a lot of fungus and a lot of algae out there.
It's one of the major food supplies for caribou.
Okay, makes sense. I mean, again, it's there's a lot of it out there, and it's relatively nutritious. You know, a plant material is problematic because more complex plants have a lot of their calories stuck in cellulose, where it's very difficult to digest. So I could believe that. Okay, since that one went so fast, I'll give you one more before we turn it over to Paul. Botanically speaking, what is a curious common attribute of both watermelons and bananas that cannot be said of strawberries, blackberries, nor raspberries?
KD2FIU.
Say again?
KD2FIU.
Right.
Vitamin C.
No, any other suggestions out there? You can guess. There's no problem. I don't take points off.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich.
I will take a guess that bananas and watermelons outgas that the other fruits do not.
That's an interesting thing, but no, that's not what I'm getting at. Anyone else with any thoughts about what the common botanical attribute of watermelons and bananas that isn't something you can say about strawberries, blackberries, or raspberries?
MI2H.
Yes, Lou.
They give off neutrinos.
Well, bananas do. Bananas are well, a whole bunch of interesting things. They produce antimatter because they have radioactive potassium in them. So they give out positrons is what bananas are known for. Watermelon, I'm not quite sure about the amount of potassium. I mean, in a way, all plants have potassium in them, and potassium has a percentage of radioactive material that spontaneously decays. So the big news about the radioactivity of fruits tends to favor bananas. There's even a YouTube of a person who took a bunch of bananas and removed all the potassium from them and then put them next to a Geiger counter to demonstrate the principle. Okay, well, the answer is that botanically speaking, watermelons and bananas are considered to be berries. Whereas, actually, botanically speaking, strawberries, blackberries, and raspberries are not botanically berries. The problem is that a botanical description of a berry requires that the fruit be made up of one ovary and not a cluster of different plant ovaries grouped together, which is the case with strawberries, blackberries, and raspberries. So botanically, they're not berries, but watermelons and bananas are. So go figure. Okay, anyway, with that said, I want to... about Wayne's situation, and I want to thank everyone, and of course thank Andy, WA2CDL, for Andy's Corner. I want to remind everyone that if they have any questions or topics or puzzles, what have you, the email address to reach me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. There'll be links to a whole bunch of interesting articles, so please avail yourself in the coming week. I update it every week. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com, and the stream, the audio stream to the LimeOff repeater is technet.ac2gs.com. And always remember MikeKC2NJI's wonderful archive site for all the technical nets going back from September 2006 on. So with that all in mind, I would like to bring you Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good on all of the stuff in the net so far. And, there's some topics that I have here that are not that long, so maybe we'll have time at the end if you want to do more of your puzzles. That will be up to you, Roy. But for now, Elon Musk runs SpaceX. We all know that by now. And he's desperately trying to develop his to eventually not only go to the moon, his main goal is to colonize Mars. You know, his theory is that he's going to have thousands of these things someday launched to Mars. And he plans on setting up factories big enough to turn these things out like cars. down in Boca Chica, Texas. It's pretty much taken over that whole area down there. It's right near Brownsville, near the border of Mexico. And that's where he's developing starships and testing them. He's launching them there. And eventually he wants to create a city. He's actually putting in paperwork to accommodate a lot more land than he has, develop his own little town. So that should be interesting. Last Wednesday, he launched a starship, one of the many he's built so far. The starship stands about 164 feet high. It's got a 30-foot diameter. And he's launched two of them already in the last four months. And both of them launched successfully to around 60, 70,000 feet high. And then they come down and they tilt over and they do like a belly flop all the way back down to where it took off from. He's got a landing pad there. And those first two, when they came down, it turns from a horizontal position to a vertical position. So these are three engines. They come back to life, pretty much in the last few seconds. Straightens itself out, and then right before it lands, supposed to shut its engines off, and that's supposed to be it. It should stand up vertical. Those last two, they call them SN8 and SN9, both failed at that point. They turned, and they hit the ground and blew up. I covered both those flights on the net. And he's had other flights as well from Boca Chica, Texas. First couple of them, couple of flights, he flew about 500 meters high and then flew over to the side and landed again successfully. Those were not as complicated as these. SN8, SN9, and now SN10 have these fins on them, movable fins with these big electric motors powered by batteries from the Tesla car company that Elon owns. And, sure enough, it flies itself all the way back down to where it's supposed to be. And he's just trying to, make this landing. So this SN10 was launched last Wednesday around 6:30. It was getting late. He tried to launch earlier in the day, but he had temporary scrub. One of the settings were set too sensitive, and the engines fired for a second, and then they shut right down. So he readjusted that and changed the settings. A couple of hours later, sure enough, this thing took off. And I got to see it live on there's a YouTube station that carries this. They call it Las Padre, and you hear a couple of people talking back and forth that handle it. It's sort of like amateur production, but they do pretty good. Anyway, you get to see this thing live, and it took off, sure enough, all the way up to around 6 miles high with three engines, these three very powerful, they call them Raptor engines. They're about a little more powerful than one and twice as powerful as the other engines that he uses on the Falcon 9. Falcon 9, he uses the Merlin engines. These things are called Raptor engines. The difference in fuel, the oxidizer, of course, is the same, but the fuel for the Falcon is kerosene, and the fuel for this is liquid methane. Anyway, three engines took them up to almost before they got to that 60,000 feet height, they shut one engine down, and maybe about 30 seconds later, they shut the other engine down, and then the last engine brings them up to that final height, and then that finally shuts down. The whole setup tilted over properly and flew down just like number 8, number 9 did. And then toward the end, before he gets to that point, he switches over to different tanks inside of the Starship. Your main tanks have the fuel in it, bringing you up to where you have to go, but now they're pretty much empty. But on the way down, he switches over to what he calls the header tanks, inside the vehicle near the bottom. He's got another big round tank that's got additional liquid methane in it, and near the very top of the whole rocket, he's got another tank that he has liquid oxygen in, and they're called header tanks. And sure enough, he switches over to those two tanks at last, a minute or so is on the way down. By the way, this whole flight takes about 8 minutes. So as he got right near the end, it went from horizontal to vertical with the three engines relit. Swung to a vertical position, came down, and then two engines shut off, and then the final engine was able to soft land the vehicle standing up. And it looked great, SpaceX was also covering the whole thing, and then after about a minute after it landed, the fellow that was covering it said, okay, that's it, we're going to leave the webcast for now. It's a success. But if you were watching this other YouTube thing with this amateur reporters, they said, we're going to look at this thing for a little while longer. It looked like a fire was coming out of the bottom, and it was also tilting to one side. And one fellow even said it looks like a leaning tower of pizza here. And we're going to keep watching it. And sure enough, they have robotic trucks that come out. Nobody's at it. They're shooting water out, trying to douse the flame coming out of the bottom. Apparently, it must have had a leak, or maybe a valve broke or didn't close, and fuel was still coming out. And then, sure enough, 8 minutes after it landed, the whole bottom of it blew up. The thing flew up about 50 feet into the air, 50 to 100 feet into the air. And then went over on the side, came back down, and just broke into a million pieces. But nevertheless, Elon Musk is very happy with the results. He did successfully land it vertically. But he's got to, tighten up his connections or something, or protect them some kind of barrier. Heat shield type of thing. He used that quite a bit on a Falcon 9 system. But, that was pretty interesting. And you could always see this on YouTube or even I don't know if the SpaceX website still has it. They have a beautiful picture of this thing going up, coming down, and landing. If you go to the SpaceX webcast, they call it. They might still have it up. Anyway, this is WS2N. Any questions, comments? NY2H. Good evening, Lou. NY2H. How's everything? Yeah, everything is good. So you're saying they're relocating to Texas, or they're opening up some facilities in Texas. Any trepidation on their part with the utility situation down there? Are you asking them to shore things up? They have electricity issues with the cold weather that they had. They have water supply issues. Yeah, any word on that? The town of Boca Chica is pretty much desolate, and he bought some of the people out, some of the people that were living there, and they're gone. He pretty much has taken over Boca Chica. He moved down there. I think he bought the place in 2013, and he started building this launch complex, and now he's got a tremendous tank farm down there. If you see aerial views of this, he does have electrical supply coming into into the area, so he's able to get power from Texas. There is no water supply, so he's trying to handle that on his own. But he's trying to develop this town. He wants to call it the I forget the name of it. He has some catchy name for it, Star City. Or, you know, not Star City. You can't think that. It's already taken by the Russians, but something along those lines. Anyway, he wants to create his own town, and he put papers in for he's going to handle the water situation. As far as fuel goes, he plans on drilling his own methane wells in this area. And then the methane's going to come up. He's going to cool it down with liquid nitrogen to the point where the methane will actually turn into a liquid. And he'll be able to utilize that liquid methane for his rockets that he's flying. So that's all I know about that, Lou. But yeah, he's been down there a long time, and many different flights. Originally, he was going to launch Falcon 9s out of this place, but now he's strictly using it for these starships that he's building. Now, this starship is 164 feet high. He's built massive buildings to construct the starship, and then another building, which is probably about three times higher than that, where he's building the, they call it the Starship Heavy. So that'll be the main booster, the first booster that will actually launch with 28 engines. This thing will have, well, right now it has three engines. By the time he's done, he's going to have six engines in it. This starship. This is the piece that will actually go on to the moon and go on to the Mars. Instead of having a two or three stage rocket, the first stage is this big booster that's going to come back, and the second stage is this what he calls the starship that he's launching now. He's trying to launch this and get this successfully done before. All right, very good, Paul. I don't know if you watched this 60-minute piece tonight or you're recording it, you're going to watch it later, but they were talking about the whether private industry or the government should be more involved, and the people on the government side were talking about all the jobs, it created. The senators, of course, want to let their people feel that they're creating work for them or saving their jobs. And, the other hand, the more economical side of it seemed to be with the private industry, so they had a little debate over that. Yeah, I did record it, so I haven't seen it yet. But it sounds like they're tossing the idea of what's better, the NASA programs like the STS, the Space Transportation System that NASA's building, or letting private people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos has Blue Origin. Many companies that are involved with this, Rocket Lab is involved now. They're launching the Electron rocket on a regular basis. Now they just came out with a brand new one that they're going to build and launch before 2024 called the Neutron. So Neutron will actually be capable of not only cargo, but eventually people. So I guess it sounds like the debate is between private industry or NASA itself. I don't think you can have one without the other. But I don't know. I haven't seen the report yet. Thank you.
Well, euphemistically, they were calling STS the Senate Transportation System. So there you go. All right. Thank you, Paul. NY2H, I'll be clear.
Oh, yeah. Well, like any, you know, politics is what drove the, what helped drive the space program in the first place. Everybody wanted a piece of the action, you know, when Apollo was being developed, Gemini and Mercury, everybody had their hands in it, you know, to get this passed. You needed, you know, JPL, you needed California people to vote for that, you needed Alabama to down in Huntsville, because that's where the Redstone was being built for Mercury. And the Titan rockets for Gemini itself, places being built in Louisiana, Mississippi's massive buildings, components to test massive rockets that everybody at Long Island, of course, with Grumman. You had Virginia, Goddard with all the satellites and Hubble, and you can think about it. You know, without the senators voting for things, you probably wouldn't have had a space program. We dropped it. But, you know, because of that, I mean, that gets everything going. And sure enough, the private industry eventually starts to pick up on this. Elon Musk is going nuts. He's going full blast on this. And then some of the other ones are doing pretty good, too, but not like him. And now, you know, they're building rockets. They're actually having NASA as a customer. They're building the rockets. They got a lot of seed money from NASA. Now their rockets are developed. They built the Crew Dragon to send people four at a time to the International Space Station. SpaceX, you know, they'll be able to use their rockets with nothing to do with NASA to send those rockets somewhere else, maybe to another private space station. So, no, I think it's just evolution. But government money definitely kicked things off. Any other comments? Okay, let me go on here. There was a spacewalk. There's actually been a couple of spacewalks over the last couple of weeks. But this last one by Kate Rubin, and she's a ham, KG5FYJ, and Noguchi, KD5TVP from Japan. They went out on a spacewalk a couple of days ago. And their goal was to start work on upgrading the solar panels for the space station. I'll get to that in a minute, but one of the projects that they were going to do at the very end, if they had time, was to straighten out these connections going from the Columbus module over to the Bartholomew experimental section, which is located outside of the space station, where they're going to have experiments going on. And unfortunately, they never got to it. One of the cables that they were going to get involved in rerouting had to do with the ham radio connection between the Kenwood radio inside Columbus and Aries uses a station. That radio has not been working for the last couple of months because of an earlier EVA that they were doing. They relocated a cable for this Bartholomew experiment outside the Columbus module. And they say, I think it's part of that cable, I'm not sure, but it has something to do with this relocation. And ever since then, amateur radio has not been working on the Columbus module. In fact, they had a schedule with a school in Wyoming, but they had to call it off I guess they're going to get rescheduled. Anytime that happens, they don't forget about the school. They just get rescheduled down the road a piece or maybe even next year. But anyway, temporarily, they're using the Russian ham radio section in the Zvezda module, you know, the Russian side of the space station, which is... they also have a Kenwood radio involved there that they're able to use. So temporarily, they'll use that. This other one was supposed to be fixed the other day. But, you know, I mean, it's not just that cable. You know, they have a series of cables that have to do with powering up and data cables for experiments. They couldn't put these two... connectors together. I don't know how many pins are involved. It looked like about 10 pins, what I saw on TV. But 10 pins that they can't push together. And they think that maybe because of the temperatures, one contracted, they might have contracted too much. So they have a gadget that looks like a male section of this plug deal. They're going to push it into the female end before they actually make the connection. They're going to try to force open these connections. And if it works, then they'll be able to mate it. And hopefully that will be able to bring back, you know, one of those connections might be the one for the ham radio. Anyway, they ran out of time. And got up to 6 hours or so, and they were unable to complete it. So we'll see what happens. They have many more spacewalks in the weeks and months ahead to address that problem. Any questions or comments? WSY. Now, you know, further information on that EVA, like I was saying before, the main purpose was to... advance or, you know, upgrade the solar system, the solar panels. They call them SOARs, solar array wings. So there's four SOARs on the International Space Station. Collectively, they put out originally, you know, around almost 200 kilowatts. But they start to degrade over time, and they've been flying around up there since, you know, for 20 years now. So some of the panels are starting to degrade. One set of panels is really very good. So they plan on putting new solar panels in front of some of those. You know, it's going to shadow it. I mean, parts of it will still be sticking out. So it will still be useful, but the new panels will really add to a lot of power. Right now, they're down to around 160 kilowatts. And once these things are shadowed by the new ones, they would be down to about 95. But the new ones are much more efficient. The old ones, they said, were 14% efficient. These things are 30% efficient, so it's like doubling it. They're about half the size of the old one. And, well, anyway, once they get it all together, they'll have a total of 215 kilowatts use for the space station. When the space station was originally designed, they knew they were going to use a lot of power, but it turns out as the years went on, they added more modules and they added more experiments. They used a lot more power than they thought. I mean, even when a spacecraft goes up and docks with the ISS, that spacecraft no longer uses its own power to sit up there for the next 6 months waiting for the crew to return. They tap into those solar panels. And now they have sometimes six, I've even seen seven spacecraft attached to the space station at one time. Anyway, Kate Rubin, like I said, she's a ham, and a fellow from Japan, went out on, it turns out, about 6.5 hours. They were trying to do about 8 hours, but about 6.5 hours. to attach these struts to, well, they're only working on one of these solar wings for now. I mean, this is what's going to be made, spacewalks, where other guys are going to go out and do the same thing to the other solar wing. They get down to the base, and basically they're hooking up struts connected to this gigantic canister that holds the, actually rotates the solar panels. In this case, it was out of P6, fourth side, six, all the way at the very end. That they're doing that set first. And they have these bolts that they bolted into, they bolted these struts into this gigantic canister. And they utilize bolt holes that weren't even being used. They were originally there for transportation when they were on Earth. They don't need them anymore, but they're going to utilize them. They come out with this set, you know, coming out from the top, and then another set of struts coming out from the bottom, another set in the middle, and then one, looks like one big, kind of like an L bracket from one end to the other. From that L bracket, in the future, they'll be attaching the new solar arrays. Solar arrays, instead of this accordion system that, you know, that you used to see, you see a satellite being launched, Dragon Dragon crew vehicle is different now, but the Dragon cargo vehicles, before they change over, they have panels that fold out like an accordion. Same thing with the Progress vehicles that launched with the Soyuz spacecraft. You know, they all fold like a, unfold like an accordion. In fact, these massive solar panels that are on the space station now are probably 200 feet long and maybe 44 feet wide. You know, when they were originally put up there too, they opened up like an accordion. These roll out, the new ones, they're called the ROSA, roll out solar arrays. So that's where they get ROSA from. And they've actually tested this on a previous flight, a smaller version of it. But of course, it's going to be very big. They'll attach it to this L bracket, and then they'll expand the whole setup. You have this one rod in the middle, and then on the ends that hold the solar panels. Instead of having angle iron or pipe or anything like that, you have this set up, this composite material that's rolled up, you know, and squeezed together. So once it's released, it will unroll itself. As it does, it will actually pull the, it'll actually unroll these solar panels from a gigantic roll, from a massive paper towel roll, you know, if you want to look at it that, like that. So it's a much less expensive way of doing it. All motors to worry about to drive it open, to get these things open. It's going to be half the size of the existing solar panels. And yet it's going to put out twice the amount of power. So anyway, our two ham radio spacewalkers were successful in doing all of that. Kate developed a pinhole in a glove. They always do a glove check. If you watch an EVA every half hour, so they'll say, do a glove check. They have these helmet cams, on their helmet. They can look at their hands. And sure enough, she found a pinhole in a glove. But they checked the gauges, and actually monitors how much pressure was in your system. Got the suit, and they saw no leak whatsoever. There was no unexpected leak. Anyway, I'm sure that glove will be looked at. Probably brought back to Earth in a future flight on a Dragon spacecraft. But they cut it short because they needed a lot more time. They had 6.5 hours, but they needed probably about three and a half more hours at least.
to complete making these connections that I was talking about before that would have brought the amateur radio back online. You know, and I'm sure all the scientists don't care about the amateur radio. They want their Bartolomeo external porch that's going to, you know, have all these experiments with KA and KU band transmissions constantly being transmitted down to Earth. Which, by the way, they haven't done really for the space station. They use, you know, KU, which is tremendous bandwidth. They can get, you know. But the, you know, KA is great, but KU is even better. And that's all part of this whole setup that they're going to be working on. But part of that is fixing the this cable system that failed on the in the Columbus module where the ham shack is. Any questions or comments? WS2M. Okay, talking about the different states having different equipment in there, different states and factories making stuff. And I mentioned Mississippi before, and they have one that, you know, maybe about 35 stories tall that they use to test rocket engines. So bring in rocket engines and then eventually put the first stage booster into it and load it up with fuel, or whatever fuel might be in this case. I'm talking about liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. This is a NASA STS, or like Luke said, the Senate Transportation System. This was used for around the shuttle years ago, the same engine. Anyway, STS is planned on eventually launching to the moon. And they're looking at, well, the Trump administration said 2024. I'm not seeing that. I'm probably seeing earliest 2026, maybe even 2028, by the time they actually land somebody on the moon. But anyway, this rocket, it needs to be developed, a throwaway rocket. They call it expendable. Sounds like Elon Musk with his reusable rockets. All of his rockets are reusable. But NASA still wants to throw these things away. But this thing will have over 10 million pounds, I think it's around 10.5 million pounds of thrust when it launches, which is much more than the Saturn V that took our astronauts to the moon, which was 7.5 million pounds of thrust. But to do that, they need to test the engine. Now, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, they tested it in this stand in Mississippi. And sure enough, it lit off. It was supposed to go for 8 minutes. It went for around 90 seconds. It shut itself down. The computer saw something it didn't like. And whatever it was, they worked on it. They planned on doing it again, I think, a week or two ago. But they realized that one of the valves, liquid oxygen valve, they call it a pre-valve, was not closing, not opening all the way when they were testing it. So they had to go in there and fix that. I thought that was going to be a delay of months on end, but it turns out it's only going to be like a 3-week delay. Anyway, probably in a few weeks, maybe a month, they'll be able to test these four engines again. You might remember the space shuttle had three of these RS-25 engines for the space shuttle, and then to the port side and to the starboard side, they had these solid boosters. But they would all, you know, be on from the ground all the way up. Eventually, solid boosters would separate, but you always saw those three engines still lit. They're using the same engines, the exact same engines that the shuttle used, except refurbished and improved, for these flights. They're going to be able to put out around 109% the
power that they used to. You know, each one is going to be over 500,000 pounds of thrust, I think around 550,000 pounds of thrust. So instead of using three, they're using four, and they're putting them on the bottom of this this tank, the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen tank. You know, different than the space shuttle. The space shuttle, they had the tank bolted to the body, you know, the belly of the space shuttle. They're taking those same engines. The difference is the shuttle, those engines were reusable. They would fly them back and they would work on them. I mean, it was a lot of work. They didn't think it was going to be that much work to do it in the 1970s when they developed it. But then, anyway, they used to rework these engines and then they would refly again on the space shuttle. So they had 16 of these engines left over. And now they're building more because they plan on flying a lot more than four flights to the space station, four or five flights. They plan on maybe, not to the space station, just to the moon. And they need to have a lot more of these engines. So 16 will, you know, only give them four flights. So Aerojet Rocketdyne is that building these engines. RS-25 engine. So, you know, it's
that time complete.
I want to see the test. It's supposed to light off for at least 8 minutes. They need like 8.5 minutes to duplicate the flight going uphill when they launch. So, they need to do that. They have to check their readings, make sure it's okay. If that's all okay, then they'll ship it out to Florida from Mississippi. And eventually they'll start stacking things together. They'll eventually have the upper stage, an interim upper stage that's going to be used with one big engine on it. That's also going to be liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And above that, eventually they'll put the Orion spacecraft, which was capable of carrying four people, all the way to the moon, or, you know, like they said, originally they wanted to use this to send people to Mars as well. But they'll be happy to get everybody to the moon first. Any questions or comments? WS2N. Okay, a couple of other things, but not much more. There's going to be a relocation of the crew vehicle on the International Space Station for the Russian side, and eventually they're going to do that on the American side as well. Every once in a while they'll want to relocate that vehicle for whatever reason it might be. In this case, it's the Russian Soyuz vehicle that has to be relocated because later this year the Russians plan on sending up Nokia, which is another word for science in Russian. Nokia module will be attached to the Russian space station. Very large module that they've been looking to send up for years. It's got a gallery in it, and it has a bathroom, and, you know, the sleeping quarters. So it's going to add to the Russian side. But to do that, they need to get the spacecraft that is attached or near the Nokia, where it's going to be connected. Relocate that for now. So they're going to pull out of what's called the RADFET module and relocate to the POISC module on top of the space station. These spacecraft will be done automatically. They can dock and undock automatically. So essentially, they're going to have to undock from one port, go to the top of the space station, and dock it to the other port. And what they do is they put the whole crew, three that went up there. The Russians, which are up there now, and plus an American, Kate Rubin. So what they do is they actually get into that spacecraft to make that relocation. They get the flight rules to have these people inside the space station and watch this thing do it automatically. Because if something happens, fire on board or some other